Hello, welcome to Pharma Marketing Talk. This is your host, Pharma Guy, also known as John Mack. And today my guest is my friend, RJ Lewis, who is the president and CEO of eHealthcare Solutions. And we're going to be talking about his new book titled Results, The Future of Pharmaceutical and Healthcare Marketing, which he co-authored with a few other people, Scott Weintraub, Brad Sittler, Joanne McHugh, and Roger Zhang, and Stephen Morales. I don't know all those people, but we have RJ here to talk about the book and especially the issues that he wrote about regarding digital marketing now and in the future. Hi, RJ. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
So I did tell people a little bit about you, but if you wanted to flesh that out a little bit more, we have a long history going back to before the internet, correct?
Yes, you and I have known each other way back when you were at Versa, I believe, still doing what you're doing now in a consulting capacity for a lot of different companies. And I was working at a company called Physicians Online. And then we actually worked together for a while when MediConsult bought Physicians Online, if I recall.
Right.
So we go way back to the proprietary online service days, pre-internet browsers, focused on digital interactions.
Right. So I know you do a lot of work in this space, helping, I believe, mostly healthcare companies and pharmaceutical companies deliver their ads to different websites and so on. I'm not quite sure how much else you do at eHealthcare Solutions.
Sure. So after Physicians Online, as the internet erupted and exploded and browsers proliferated, I became fascinated with the online advertising network model, which was a centralized distribution model for advertising. And 16 years ago, I founded eHealthcare Solutions, which was at the time the first vertical advertising network. There were other big networks out there like 24/7 Media, Real Media, DoubleClick when they were a network at the time, advertising.com and others, but they all focused very broadly. They were all an inch deep and a mile wide. And when you looked at a segment for them, healthcare, which was arguably one of their smallest segments because they had business and finance and automotive and entertainment and all these other categories, there wasn't much in the way of targeting. If you talk to those companies about reaching, oncologists in the early days, it wasn't even on their radar. Their options were limited to things like women's health, men's health, and children's health as targeting options. So we said we're going to be a vertical in the healthcare space. We're going to be an inch wide and a mile deep, and we're going to get very granular with our targeting efforts, being able to contextualize and target things like breast cancer, colorectal cancer, et cetera, very down to a granular level. And I felt we missed an opportunity at Physicians Online because we were myopically focused on the professional space, where when DTC was burgeoning all around us and there was a huge opportunity to help clients on the consumer side. And I had many conversations with the clients where they were saying, hey, RJ, we love what you're doing with us on the professional side, but I've got a big mandate to reach consumers. What can you do? And we didn't have a solution. So I started eHealthcare Solutions with the intent of saying, hey, we're going to focus on all the key constituents. We're going to look at physicians, healthcare professionals, nurses, pharmacists, et cetera. We're going to look at patients. We're going to look at the payer. And we're going to be of service to clients throughout the whole spectrum of all of their customers, of which there are many.
Why don't you start by telling us why you decided to write this book now?
The healthcare industry is in probably the most disruptive state that I've ever seen it in my career of 20 plus years. A lot of people thought that the healthcare pharmaceutical industry could not be disrupted by digital technology. And it's not digital technology alone that's disrupting it, but there's a whole series of factors. Digital is certainly one of them, both on the marketing side, but also on the digital health side, where devices and other things are actually being used now to monitor patients remotely, and the whole notion of telemedicine, all those types of revolutions or evolutions are happening as well, which are disrupting the marketplace as well. But the other big disruptive factor is the government with the ACA, and the intended or in some cases unintended consequences of what is happening around the rollout of that law. One of the big trends that we see happening is the disempowerment of the physician. We did a poll with a number of pharmaceutical executives a couple of weeks ago at a lunch, and we asked them, who's your key customer? And today, the majority of them, and we put options on the interactive polling, you know, physicians, patients, the government, payers, large employers, those types of options. And today, the majority, but it was close, the majority still said the physician was the key customer. And then we did a second poll, and we said, who's going to be your key customer in 3 years? If I were to ask you this question again in 3 years, how do you think, sitting here today, you would answer it? And it shifted radically. The payer went up to number one, the patient became number two, and the physician became number three. And I think that's reflective of the change that's happening in the marketplace. Physicians don't really have the same choice that they had before on what to prescribe because it's being mandated by payers, and it's being controlled to a large extent through technology. So often the handheld device they might be using only has three choices of an antibiotic, and they can't go beyond that. And if they pick number three, they're going to get a phone call and asking why they didn't pick number one, because it's all about you know, cost savings on the payer side. So those are some of the big changes, and it's why we decided to kind of sit back and say, hey, what's in store? Let's look at the crystal ball and look at what's happening. As you pointed out, I focused on the digital marketing chapter because that's my area of expertise. And just to give kind of a high-level overview of the book, Scott Weintraub, who's the CMO for Healthcare Regional Marketing, former brand manager for Lipitor, he did the chapter on regional marketing, which is another growing trend in terms of being able to really figure out what are the key brand drivers in particular areas throughout the country and rethink the way you align your sales force. Brad Sittler did the chapter on big data. Brad came from SAS, and obviously they focus a lot on big data. He talks about how it's impacting healthcare. And then evolving systems of care and the ACA in particular was done by several folks that you mentioned, Roger, Joanne, and Stephen over at Navigant Healthcare Consulting. And there's actually a final chapter that Scott and I did, which is a view from the pharmaceutical manufacturer's perspective, where we interviewed about 25 different pharmaceutical executives, and we summarized their thoughts. We put a lot of direct quotes and their specific views into that chapter, although their thinking clearly shaped the evolution of the whole book. We wanted to focus in specifically on what pharma was thinking, as well as medical device in that chapter as well.
Well, you certainly have a history in digital marketing, and that's what you're focused on in your chapter that you wrote in the book. And I have a lot of comments that I've marked off, and you talking about reaching specific audiences. And one of the things you mentioned in your chapter is that you can even reach and target ads for specific physicians, which I found, pretty interesting. So before we get into nitty-gritty details like that, what do you think are the biggest trends that you see happening in digital marketing for the future, especially with regard to the pharmaceutical industry?
So there's a lot of trends happening in digital. There's so many of them. So I'm going to kind of narrow it down to just a couple.
Let's try to focus a little bit on, this targeting, how that's evolving. The data-driven is part of that, but also I'm very much interested in programmatic marketing or ad buying. Those kinds of things seem to, and the mobile aspect. So there's a lot to cover, but go ahead, pick your choice to start with.
So let's start with targeting, because that's really at the core of what we do as a company, and it's really at the core of what I've done my entire career. So going back to Physicians Online, I actually give an example in the book from Physicians Online. where we were doing a remarkable targeted campaign targeting specific physicians in specific regions with data from SDI at the time on the status of the flu in their areas. So you would get a banner that would say, Dr. Mack, personalized to you by last name, the Newtown area where you live is on alert status for the flu. The banner would be color-coded based on it if it was alert, pre-alert, or normal. So you'd either get a red, yellow, or green banner. And it would be dynamic with last name, your area, and the status of the flu in your area. And then when you clicked into it, you went into an interactive experience that actually did comparisons of how the flu season is this year compared to last year. Because as a practitioner, you remember what you went through last year. And if it's 2.5 times as bad, you say, wow, we're in for a season. That kind of personalization we were doing 20 years ago. Now, what's happened, and that's kind of the promise of one-to-one marketing that digital has always offered, what's happened with the proliferation of the web is it's become a completely open infrastructure where everything's interconnected. And we're pretty much nearing that place again today to be able to do that type of targeting, but on a much larger scale across the entire internet. I think the only real, it's not technology that's limiting the ability to do that as much as it's things like user privacy. People are concerned about putting your last name onto a banner on a site that you never gave your last name to, even though you're recognizable to either the ad provider or the end client because you've registered somewhere else and they've identified who you are through a cookie or through some other form of a beacon.
That's kind of interesting. I know that Physicians Online was a closed system where everybody on the site had already logged in with their information, so it was relatively easy to identify them based upon the data within Physicians Online. But now what you're talking about is you can kind of do the same thing based on information that's been provided almost anywhere on the internet, including social media, if a physician logs in somewhere and that information is shared somehow. Or I know you talked about beacons. There's a lot of technical stuff here. So is that the idea, basically, what used to be, only possible within a closed system where people registered is now possible in the open system of the internet?
Yes, to a large extent it is. But we're kind of coming full circle. So the pendulum is swinging. In the early days of proprietary online services, it was all closed system. The web came along and disrupted that and made everything open and interconnected. And now we're actually swinging back more towards closed systems. So big trend towards people targeting or audience targeting where you're not, the internet really grew up on contextual targeting, placing a diabetes ad on a diabetes page, for example. But the big trend now is towards specific people targeting or segment targeting. So identifying, let's say, physicians who are high writers for diabetes brands and targeting those people specifically. And this is kind of where programmatic comes in, because once you've identified the person, you're not really limited to reaching them on a medical journal. You can reach them on CNN or Yahoo or wherever they might be going. I say we're heading back towards closed systems because when you look at the largest players that are driving this, the Facebooks, the Googles, the Apples, they have essentially closed ecosystems. They know who those users are. And they're allowing for targeting, but in a segmented basis. So you can go to a Facebook or a Google and you can upload an email list, for example. And they're going to come back with a reasonable match of people that you can reach, and then you can start to put sponsored links into the feeds of just those people. The place it's going, though, I believe, is we're going to eventually go back to open. Closed historically hasn't won. We'll see if it does. Apple's made a couple of good runs at it. They lost the first time. They're doing quite well now. But they're taking more of a hybrid approach. They all are. They're closed systems, but they're also fairly open. Facebook is probably a great example of a company who's really leading the charge to break down privacy barriers. So you'll probably see some of the most interesting things happen there in terms of personalization. You already see quite interesting things in your sponsored newsfeed links where you're saying, how do they know I want that? And it's it's all based on big data. They've got a tremendous amount of data based on your surfing patterns and who you are and your friends and who influences you. And they have a pretty good sense for what drives you decision making.
So far, it's not perfect. I keep getting, you know, emails about being nominated for the Best Woman in Healthcare Award or something like that. So I don't know how they got that. But we'll talk a little bit more about privacy, something that's very interesting to me. But another thing that maybe you can touch upon in terms of what does the future hold, I'm interested in the platforms such as mobile and video. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So let's talk about mobile, because it's really remarkable how quickly mobile has kind of taken over mind share for the consumer and for the physician, especially for the physician. Many of our publishing partners have crossed the 50% threshold of their traffic coming from mobile. As has been typical, pharma's a little late to the party. They tend to not follow the audience until they're there in much larger numbers, often 60, 70, 80%. Then they start to, change their spending ratios. That said, pharma participates in mobile indirectly through the mobile web. So advertising that appears on websites, if it's being viewed on a browser or a mobile device, oftentimes pharma's going to be there as well. Pharma struggles a bit with smaller mobile formats because of all the regulatory requirements, fair balance, displays, et cetera, that have to happen. So I believe the future of mobile for pharma in particular is more around custom ad units. We're experimenting with some of these now, where we offer scrolling ISI within the ad unit, or full screen units where there's more space, because that's always a challenge for pharma in terms of getting their all of their legal required information onto the ad unit. But mobile is just exploding. It is a mobile world. Desktops are morphing. They're becoming smaller and leaner, and you can put the screen around, and they're starting to look and feel a lot more like tablets. Mobile devices are getting bigger. You got the phablets, the iPhone 6, 6 Plus. They're getting larger. So we're kind of going to meet in this happy medium, and I think the lines, much like the word E fell off of marketing, and people still refer to digital marketing, but now it's often multi-channel. It's just one more channel. Mobile, I think, as a adjective, will kind of fall away. It's just going to be digital interaction, knowing that a lot of that happens through mobile. And at some point, the vast majority or all of it's going to happen through mobile. So trend-wise, it's you can't ignore it.
You did mention about getting all the ISI and the small areas, and that was something that came up with the FDA when it came out with its guidelines for pharma using social media with limited space. They focus mostly on Twitter. And I suggested that, Twitter now allows photos and to be added to the tweet, and that could be used maybe to display ISI. And then we talked about mobile, and then FDA had to come out and say these guidelines don't apply to mobile. So do you think that's going to be holding up the pharmaceutical industry in terms of doing more with the mobile as it is today?
Yes. You did an article several years ago when John Paul Hepp and I had an interaction when he was at Pfizer as the chief privacy officer, I believe was his title at the time. And he kind of stood up and said, hey, my number one job is to protect the brand. You guys all have great ideas about growing the brand, but I have to protect it. That's the number one thing I think about. And I think that kind of very highly conservative attitude still very much exists. So, any restrictions like that are going to slow down adoption for pharma. But that's where it's incumbent on us as digital marketers and as support companies for pharma to really get creative on how we deliver messaging so that we can work within the regulatory framework. When I first got into pharma marketing, I did it in large part because of a challenge. I had an early boss at Gray challenge me during an interview And she said, you know, anybody can market grape jelly, but try marketing a product that has a black box warning on it that says it, this product could kill you, and do it within the confines of the FDA regulation, and still move share. That's a challenge. And that's kind of what drove me into this business, is that, you know, when you force yourself to operate within those regulatory constraints, it really forces the creativity in terms of how to still get that message across in an environment that is highly regulated.
I'm surprised it didn't drive you out of the business.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate, but I think it does drive a lot of people out of the business. You know, it's one of pharma's bigger challenges, I think, is challenging, you know, whether it's on the R&D side to kind of the more exciting biotech advances, or whether it's, you know, whether it's on the creative side where people do get frustrated. I mean, you and I probably both know a ton of people throughout our careers who are not in the industry anymore, and it's a frustration factor. You know, they came in, they yeah. banged their head against the wall for so long, and they said, you know, I'm going to go somewhere else. This is crazy.
Especially those people that have won my Pharma Guy Pioneer Award. I see a lot of them have kind of left the industry. But let's talk a little bit about something else in the chapter you wrote that I'm interested in, the auction-based model. I guess this is part of programmatic marketing. Can you explain that, how that works a little bit, and what you think is going to, how that's going to influence pharma marketing in the future?
Sure. So programmatic, think about like a stock exchange. That's essentially how programmatic buying works. You've got a buyer. You've got a seller, buyer of ad impressions or inventory. You've got a seller of ad impressions, inventory. That the buyer operates through what's called a DSP or a demand-side platform, some kind of a trading desk where they can go in and say what they want in terms of inventory. It's not just about ad sizes and specific sites or placements, but it's also about targeting criteria, contextualization, things like audience segments. So they might be saying, hey, here's my cookie pool of 50,000 people I've identified, and these are the people I want to reach. I don't particularly care where I reach them, or I want to reach them on this whitelist. I want to reach them anywhere on the internet except for this blacklist of sites. So they have some options in terms of how they choose to buy. Then you have sellers who come in through an SSP or a supply-side platform, and they go in and they make their inventory available. And typically, at least today, the inventory they're making available isn't their best inventory, because they're selling the best inventory directly through their sales force. But they might have an impression at the bottom of a page that's not monetized. So they make it available to the exchange. And in essence, what's happening is it's computer-to-computer buying. So each time that impression comes in, all the different demand sides are looking at that impression, looking specifically at the cookie pool around that impression, seeing if it's somebody they might know or understand or want to reach, and they're making a bid, and they're saying, hey, I would pay, you know, 82 cents for this impression, and somebody else is saying, I would pay $1.05, and somebody else is saying, I'd pay $3. So in that example, what typically is going to happen is the guy who's bidding $3 is going to win that bid, but he's not going to pay $3. He's going to pay a penny over the $1.05. That was the second highest bid, so he'll win that impression for $1.06 CPM.
Yeah, I'm. You know, there's lots of things here running through my mind. It's all done by computer, first of all, I guess. Once you put in, you know, your criteria, and hopefully you've put in the right information, so you don't, the computer doesn't do strange things with the information you mentioned, blacklist and whitelist and stuff like that. Is there a possibility of, you know, I know there's a lot of stocks, when you compare it to the stock market, and computer trading on the stock market has been problematic in the past sometimes. Is there any kind of analogy here with that, or is this completely different, really?
I saw a stat. There's 10x the data flowing through buying today versus the data that flows through the stock market. So it's actually a system that's significantly bigger in terms of scale, which is kind of amazing to think about. Now, the stock market, you're trading stocks worth, you know, dollars, hundreds of dollars, et cetera, mostly in programmatic. It's fairly low volume transactions. You know, it's not uncommon to be able to buy, you know, advertising for under a dollar programmatically or a buck or two, but it's relatively inexpensive most of the time, depending on your segment. Some can get very expensive depending on who you're reaching. But yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges for programmatic today. This notion of, I think what you're alluding to when you compared it to the stock market and the problems is fraud. Like Michael Lewis's book about Flash Boys, where you're basically jumping ahead of a trade by milliseconds to get a better price. And yes, that is a bit of a problem in programmatic buying today, but the stakes aren't quite as high, in terms of because the transaction volume is very low. So I don't think people are investing the same kind of dollars in the infrastructure to be, 1 foot away from the data room type of thing with the biggest fiber cable like it was happening on Wall Street. That said, the potential is there. I think the greater potential is you've got, some very, very large buyers in the system, and then you've got some very, very small ones and or sellers. The web is still controlled by a handful of very, very large companies that eat up 80% of the revenue volume, the Googles, Facebooks, Apples, et cetera. So I think that potential exists. The greater problem that exists today in programmatic is just outright ad fraud. So we're sending robots and spiders out to web pages and having computers load pages essentially in order to drive inflated impressions. And a lot of that's being exposed through better technologies that are looking at things like viewability. Was the ad actually physically on the screen, or did it just load on the page at the bottom of the page and the user never scrolled down to the bottom of the page? So it was never actually seen. It loaded and counted as an impression, but nobody ever actually physically saw the ad.
That gets into another thing you talked about in the book, which I just want to mention. It was interesting. You talked about the future where you're paying for outcomes, just as in healthcare, the future is rewarding pharmaceutical companies for outcomes and based on their medicines and the treatment of patients and data from electronic health records. You're saying the same thing is happening in digital advertising, where it's just not page impressions, it's just not clicks. It's did they do something that the marketer wanted them to do as an outcome. Is that fair to say as a future trend?
Yeah, I would actually refer to that more as a past trend. So pharma has always been one of their skill sets and core competencies to some extent is the use of data in terms of understanding their customer segment and how their marketing messages are influencing customer behavior and moving scripts. Pharma has always held its suppliers, partners, vendors to a very high standard in terms of demonstrating measuring ROI. So what the analogy I tried to make in the book there was that process that's happened for 20, 30 years, at least as long as I've been in the space, by pharma and their expectations around their suppliers, that same process is essentially being applied to them now through the ACA. So there's some irony there.
right.
Payers now and hospital systems are saying, hey, we want to see real-world data. Clinical trials are nice, but they're created in a perfect environment. And the reality is we don't live in a perfect environment. We're dealing with patients who are non-compliant. We're dealing with situations that don't happen in a clinical trial. So while the clinical trial data will get you in the door for a discussion, we want to see real-world data. We want to see how this impacts the outcomes of the patient in the long run. And their feet are being held to the fire in terms of, and that's what we want to pay for. So that's why there's this move towards going beyond the pill or pill plus, where pharma's looking at services to wrap around their products so that they can move further down towards the outcome-based solution. They're really morphing into, at least the more advanced of them are morphing into more of a healthcare company than just a pill manufacturer. So that they can show and demonstrate in the real world a better outcome for a patient.
Well, how does that translate to the marketing world? Do we do beyond the impression? Is that where we're going?
So, farm has always looked to its suppliers to say, hey, you know, there's a continuum for digital advertising, right? It kind of starts with a CPM or a sponsorship where you're paying for the impression. But they've always kind of pushed down and say, hey, I don't want to pay for the impression. I only want to pay when somebody takes action. So that's, you know, cost per click advertising. And then in some cases they say, I don't even want to pay when somebody clicks, because they might come to my site and not do anything. I only want to pay when they fill out a reg form and I get a lead, or I only want a lead cost per lead, or I only want to pay when they do certain interactions like watch a KOL video.
Right.
And they have to watch at least 2 minutes of that, and that's a cost per action type of payment. So
right. Now,
holding
how many
the fire feet to the fire has been around for a long time.
Yeah, in your estimation, I don't know if you have any hard data, but cost per action, how many pharma marketers, e-marketers, are really holding their agencies to that standard? I mean, what percentage-wise would you think, instead of, you know, just cost per impression or other ways of measuring ROI?
I don't know of any agencies that are actually compensated in that form or fashion. I would think at most some might have some bonus criteria tied towards delivering a certain number of leads or moving share, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any that are 100% driven that way, though they may exist. But I think it falls more down towards the vendor. I think it's probably the next area to be, you know, cost savings to be wrung out by clients in terms of looking at their agencies and saying, hey, I don't want to pay hourly anymore. I don't want to pay in this form or fashion. You know, they kind of moved away from percentage of media, you know, and I think eventually they'll move away from hourly too and say, hey, I'm only going to pay you, Mr. Agency, if you actually move my share. That would not surprise me at all if those conversations are happening.
Okay. We've been talking quite a while, and I want to make sure that you can mention anything that we haven't talked about, but maybe you want to talk a little bit about the view from the manufacturer, the last chapter of the book where you interviewed several people. Any lasting learning impressions that you got from that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One of the kind of main themes that came out of it, and I think it was Craig DeLarge in an early interview who kind of painted this picture in terms of the future, and then we used that in several of the other interviews to kind of get other people to weigh in and see what they thought about it. But one of the things he said was, hey, the industry 5 years from now, 10 years from now, it's kind of going to go down a few different potential paths. You know, one is you can remain a pill company, and you're going to be kind of marginalized in what you get. You're going to start to look a lot more like a generics manufacturer, although you may have some patent-protected brands, but you're just going to stay a pill company. Another option is you're going to start to become, and you're seeing a lot of this already, specialized pharma. You're really going to focus in on niche patient populations where margins are still very high, and you can still charge substantial amounts for your brand. But areas that other folks aren't covering, they're less competitive, and you can really have an interesting almost like a monopoly because you're the only one out there with a product that serves that audience. Another option, the third option, is you're going to move and embrace the changes that are happening, and you're going to become an outcomes-driven company. You're going to wrap services around your product. I don't think we're far away from having products that file with the FDA. It's not just about the compound. It's about the compound. It's about an adherence app. It's about some other patient care program, and all of those things combined are what gets filed. So when you get your labeling, all of those things are part of your labeling, making your product quite different and opening up the opportunities to do marketing, because marketing today is restricted based on what's in your labeling. But if all of those elements are in your labeling, you're going to be able to market a lot more and more effective in different ways. And then kind of the fourth path is either consolidation or go out of business, you know, let somebody else figure it out, but you just merge with it with a larger player. And you're seeing all of those things happen today in different degrees. And for the most part, most companies are doing a little bit of all of them. They haven't necessarily chosen their path yet. They're kind of experimenting in all areas to figure out what is the best approach. So that kind of set the framework for that chapter. And we had a lot of conversations with folks about, you know, what are you doing in those areas? I think generally the beyond the pill stuff is, you know, the specialty drugs are, you know, it's already happening and everybody's pursuing that to some extent. And you're seeing more concentration. So you're seeing asset swaps between companies where, you know, somebody's becoming, hey, we are the dominant oncology franchise. We're the dominant endocrinology franchise. So I think you're going to, that's one form of kind of developing that specialty expertise even within a well-established category. But I think you're going to see the beyond the pill stuff as kind of the next big push for trying to figure out how to look a little bit more like a healthcare company and how to have a better conversation with a payer.
Okay. RJ, we have to, finish up, and I want to make sure you tell people where they can order the book. I assume Amazon. Mention the title.
It's available online at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble. You can go to our website, theresultsbook.com, and get it as well. You can go to results-book.com if you want a free copy of the digital marketing chapter, which is the chapter that I did. But I encourage you to get the whole book.
What was that last one?
We'd love an Amazon review if for folks that have read it and found value. And if you want to reach me personally, my email is rlewis@ehsmail.com. And my Twitter handle is at rlewis.
Okay. Okay, RJ, that's great. I want to thank you for being a guest. It was a really interesting discussion that I'll make sure to write up about as much as I can. And I wish you success in your book and in your business. So thanks for being a guest.
Thank you, John. I always enjoy your podcasts, and it was an honor and a privilege to come on today. And I love to talk about this stuff, so I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's obvious you know a lot about it, so thanks again for sharing the information. And I did read the whole book, so it was pretty interesting. Thank you.
Terrific.
This is Pharma Guy saying goodbye, and thanks for listening. Until next time, bye, everybody. Bye, RJ. Have a great day.
You too.
If he were to criticize your ad campaign, you would have to fight off a strong urge to thank him. If he was to praise your marketing campaign, you would list it on your resume. Whatever side of a pharma marketing issue Pharma Guy's currently on is the right side, even if he crosses over to the other side.